Mr. Goldsmith, if you please.
Hello and welcome to the Goldsmith Odyssey, our chronological journey through the filmography of Jerry Goldsmith. I'm Clark.
I'm Yavar.
I'm Jens. Today on the show, we're taking a look at Irving Lerner's low-budget paranoid thriller City of Fear from 1959. This is the first of two films on which Lerner worked with Jerry Goldsmith, the second being Studs Lonigan a year later. One truism that you sometimes hear people express about Jerry Goldsmith is that he gets more popular composers' leftovers, scoring what are in essence inferior versions of big properties. Supergirl versus John Williams' Superman is a popular example.
And John Williams got Jurassic Park and Jerry Goldsmith got Congo. But I like Congo.
Well, I also love Congo. Anyway, in my opinion, City of Fear is the first real example of this trend in his filmography. It plays out like a much lesser version of Ilya Kazan's acclaimed entry in the genre, Panic in the Streets, scored by Alfred Newman.
Right, but Alfred Newman only got to do a main title.
Yeah, it's like 2 minutes of music in that entire score. Kazan is pretty confident that his movie would hold up without music, whereas City of Fear really requires Jerry Goldsmith to step up and compensate for its dramatic and stylistic deficiencies.
It's kind of a cliche to say, but Goldsmith probably is the most important character in this movie, in a lot of instances at least.
The score, whenever it is on, is always the most prominent thing. It really is so much in the foreground.
I'd say that this film is worth seeing for any Goldsmith fan just because of how prominent in the mix his music is.
I haven't seen, I have to confess, Panic in the Streets, which you mentioned. It's always sounded like an interesting movie, and I'd like to. But part of what interests me about this movie is the radioactive material element, because there were a lot of films in the 1950s that were essentially expressions of America's sort of post-nuclear anxiety. In fact, there are a lot of people who say the whole noir genre in general is in some ways an expression of that, but expressed very directly in the realm of science fiction and a lot of different movies, but a couple of times in film noir, Kiss Me Deadly, I think, being one of the most prominent examples. But City of Fear, too, an illustration of this kind of movie that was made during this time when a large percentage of the public was feeling that the world was a much more fragile place than it had been and everything could end in a matter of moments, which, you know, is still true today, but perhaps doesn't weigh as heavily as it did back in the 1950s with the political climate back then.
Yeah, it was a world of fear at the time.
Right. Another thing I found interesting about this movie is that it's an incredibly pitiless film. This movie is just mean as a snake. Not a very deep movie, I have to say. There's not a lot of character development here.
It's very cold feeling.
Yes, absolutely. And entirely unsentimental. Has a character who basically has no redeeming qualities whatsoever and just spirals through the movie, killing people along the way.
Hey, that's not fair. He doesn't know he's doing that necessarily to everybody.
Some
of it's accidental.
A lot of it is not accidental.
Yes, that's true.
So before we get into depth on all that, we should probably do a plot summary.
Yes, indeed. So City of Fear tells the story of Vince Riker, who's played by Vince Edwards. He's a hardened criminal who escapes from San Quentin with a canister that he believes contains a pound of uncut heroin. And he's convinced that once he finds a way to sell this stuff, he'll have enough money to make a clean getaway with his loyal girlfriend, June. But Vince quickly proves he's willing to kill anyone who stands in the way of his goal, or even an innocent bystander who might own a hat and glasses that would make a good disguise.
Yeah, that wasn't cool.
No, not cool at all. But what Vince doesn't realize is that he's actually stolen a container of Cobalt-60, a deadly substance that could wipe out millions if the canister is opened. Now, meanwhile, the other side of the movie is that the police are attempting to determine how to contain the situation.
They are running with a timeline imposed by the mayor, who feels differently and wants to inform the town.
So they're racing against the clock. The big dilemma: can Vince be found before it's too late?
So our second Goldsmith movie in a row is also our second cold open in a row. After the Columbia Pictures logo fades to black, we immediately open on an ambulance racing down the street with Goldsmith in full force with noir-styled action and suspense. The total lack of build-up, the fact that it just kind of comes right out of the gate, just gives it this feeling that we're joining the story in media res and that we're just at the end of an exciting escape or heist, which we of course are.
The most striking thing about this scene for me is the Goldsmith score, of course, which gives the movie such a sense of momentum right off the bat. It's a very intense, dynamic opening that sets the tone for what you assume will be a pretty nerve-wracking story to come.
Yeah, you get this blast of a whole bunch of the different motifs of the score all at once in the beginning, and then we go to this more regular, agitated rhythm as we cut to the car's interior and are introduced to Vince Riker.
I thought that it was an interesting way to establish the main character with his accomplice that he's pretty cold towards, even though he's dying of a wound.
He and his convict friend have an altercation over control of the steering wheel. Goldsmith then transitions into this dark statement of what I would call the score's primary motif that plays darkly after Vince's companion passes out.
In our last discussion about Black Patch, some of the themes were so subtle that we had trouble picking them out. And now we have a score that, by comparison, makes Black Patch seem so obvious with its themes. And the ones in this film are more subtle and, you know, less clear what they're tied to.
It's not as clean thematically as Black Patch, as you suggest, but this is a score that, for me, is more about texture than it is about themes. You know, he strips the violins and violas out of the orchestra, comes up with this very raw, aggressive sound, and it's, like the movie itself, incredibly unsentimental. There's nothing really conventionally melodic in this score, certainly nothing romantic or sweet. It's a very hard, intentionally abrasive work, albeit an entertaining one at times.
I was talking in our previous podcast about some scores are more following the on-screen action and giving a sense of energy and propulsion, but they're not scoring the deeper psychological character development and stuff like that, and how Black Patch was very much that more psychological score. And this feels just like the characters and performances. We're not really getting to know them deeply as people. They're speaking through their actions, and everything is kind of what it is on the surface. And the score is very complex compositionally, but it doesn't feel like it's trying to do more than just propel the action and, you know, characterize a few things.
Right.
Goldsmith's score in this opening seems structured very precisely around the editing, like in a way where he says, okay, I'm going to score this shot in this way, and when the shot changes, the music changes.
Those bongo rhythms to me also suggest a little bit of a ticking clock feel, which mm-hmm. perhaps contributes to the movie's whole race against the clock premise.
Yeah, immediately following that first scene, still in the cold open, we cut to Vince's ambulance catching up to and pulling up on a civilian vehicle, presumably with the intent of taking the car and impersonating the driver, though we fade out and go to credits before we can really process what is happening. This is the first of many times that a scene in this film ends abruptly and we're left to discern the missing piece later.
And we should mention for our listeners, this movie was cut down from its original running time. It's estimated that it initially ran about 90 minutes, and its finished running time is 75. We don't know what's missing exactly. You can kind of guess in certain places, but that may be a big part of why so many parts of this movie are a little bit perplexing or seem unfinished or weirdly vague.
Specifically, it seems like Vince's murders have been, like, somebody at some point just decided that either for censorship reasons or for artistic reasons that they thought it would be more effective not to show them. I don't know. It does make the movie feel a little choppy and confusing sometimes. But Jerry Goldsmith does this really, really nice, menacing climax at the end of that cue as Vince is walking up to the other guy's car. This score is really, really big for what this scene is.
It's working overtime.
I don't know if Jerry Goldsmith was instructed to write like this, or if it, you know, he looked at it and said, like, ah, it's this kind of movie, and it's dull as dishwater, so of course it demands a musical pummeling to keep folks from falling asleep.
Looking around at some different reactions to this movie online, I see a lot of people talking about how relentless and fast-paced it is. And it's really not an incredibly fast-paced movie, but Goldsmith makes it feel like it is. Every time his score pops up, it's just, not every time, but a huge chunk of the time, it's got this breathless sense of momentum. One more thing. In this opening stretch of the movie, and throughout the rest of the film as well, you'll hear some really cool little piano riffs, you know, low rumbling piano riffs, which were a signature of Jerry Goldsmith's scores. In this case, performed by a young man named Johnny Williams, who would go on to become a great film composer in his own right. So very cool to have him contributing to this score.
And he also collaborated with Jerry on his next feature score, Studs Lonegan, for the same director. We have heard rumors that he also performed on Jerry's first feature, Black Patch, although we haven't been able to confirm that credit.
Unsubstantiated rumors.
Right. But it's plausible because there's some prominent pianoing in Black Patch.
If one of us ever interviews John Williams, that has to be the first question. Did you perform on the Black Patch score back in 1957?
I'm sure he'd remember if it was Jerry Goldsmith's first feature score.
Sure.
Yeah. So we then kind of very abruptly cut to the main titles, which is this very eerie little theme over a silhouette of the city.
And this is sort of an inversion of the way that a lot of scores and movies work, where in many different instances you'll have, you know, a suspense cue that opens things up and then a burst of, you know, a really prominent driving melody over the main titles or whatever. But in this case, it goes the other way, where you've got the really exciting music over the cold open and then this more atmospheric music that you'd expect to accompany an actual scene over the main titles.
Thank you. almost sounds like some incidental music out of one of his later horror scores.
Yeah.
Or perhaps earlier horror scores, like Dr. Jekyll. It's kind of eerie, right? It's got that same sort of something's off feel to it. It's underlying. It's not in your face.
It's definitely in that ballpark.
I was thinking of like Mephisto Waltz.
Ah. I agree with Clark that it's very unusual. I can't even off the top of my head think of another film that does this where the score is so punchy and in your face to open the movie before the titles and then continues in such subdued fashion under the actual title sequence. Usually the title sequence is the excuse for the composer to go all out and they're free from sound effects and dialogue and they can just make their mark. But Jerry really pulls back unexpectedly there.
And then, oddly, before the main title ends, the music suddenly, randomly almost, gets aggressive again, right there at the end.
That feels like a hard edit. It doesn't underscore anything specific, and it doesn't sync up to the timing of the credits. I think it comes just around the art direction and assistant director credits. When you hear it on album, you think that there must be something happening there, right? And it also abruptly kind of ends halfway through the theme. It's not something that Jerry would usually do.
So if I had to theorize, I'd say maybe there was something like originally the credits ran shorter and he composed it for that and then it cut to something else happening and he was underscoring that change, but then they decided to leave that out later and just extend the credit sequence a little bit but kept his music the same. And that wouldn't really surprise me if something like that happened with this movie because there are moments when it belies its low budget nature. It's not like it's necessarily sloppily made, but you could tell that there are certain times when maybe they would have done another take or something like that, you know, to prevent some little thing being off, but they don't with this movie because they just had to churn it out in a very small number of days.
An alternate possibility is that the cold open originally ran longer and the rest of that cue was actually meant to underscore the rest of that scene and then climax with something, perhaps the murder of that guy, and he never got around to actually doing a proper main title cue. I don't know.
Oh, you're thinking it might be underscore.
That's what it feels like to me. So that's my suspicion, is that maybe the cold open originally ran a bit longer, but we shall never know.
Some of the best music in the score, some of the most exciting action music in the score, actually does not appear in the film. There's a bit of chase music from the end of the movie that is truly some fantastic, you know, early Goldsmith action structure just building up to this climax in the middle of the cue on album that in the film isn't present at all. So it makes me wonder if that chase was just another minute and a half longer, but it's just really fantastic.
Thank you.
I'm immensely curious about what it would have represented, certainly, because it's a little bit outside the standard texture of this score. So it makes me think that something particularly unusual or exciting or interesting was happening there. Maybe it is just more chasing. I don't know if either of you feel this way, but the composer who seems to hang over this score a lot for me is Bernard Herrmann. I think you can hear his voice, particularly in the second cue. Roadblock has a very Herrmann-esque feel to me. And the opening little bit in particular almost sounds like something that could have been written for The Twilight Zone.
Also, in terms of his approach to instrumentation, I think Bernard Herrmann was the first, at least the major composer in Hollywood, who would famously do unusual orchestra combinations, and he would get rid of entire sections of the orchestra and then beef up other ones, and each score of his would have a very distinct sound because of that. Like Jason and the Argonauts was woodwinds heavy. I think it had no strings, and then, of course, Psycho is all about the strings. And Jerry Goldsmith kind of has that, I guess, similar philosophy.
He certainly has his own voice even at this point, and you can hear Jerry Goldsmith's voice all throughout this score, but perhaps leaning a little bit more heavily on some of that Herrmann-esque influence than he might have done later in his career scoring something like this.
There are a couple of direct Herrmann references in this score. Here is, a motif from Vertigo.
I don't know if it's the exact one, but it's certainly reminiscent of it. It reminded me of when he kind of evokes it in the V'ger material in Star Trek The Motion Picture.
I don't want to offend people by implying that Jerry is pilfering. I mean, this score is so him in so many ways. I mean, there is bits of it where you're going to say to yourself, ooh, you know, that sounds a bit like Planet of the Apes. It's the first of those kinds of scores of his, but the score that it really foreshadows to me in a big way is The Satan Bug from 1965, which has a lot of very similar instrumentation choices and compositional methods that it employs, though it also introduces a lot of additional ideas that are more bizarre and zany than anything in City of Fear. City of Fear is a pretty straightforward score compared to Satan Bug.
We've talked about how this score tends to almost overplay things at times and is very aggressive and really scores the surface in certain moments. But there's one cue where it takes a really different approach that I found pretty striking. It's when they first start talking about Cobalt 60 and what it is and what it can do. And the music moves into this mode of quiet, almost, you know, subtle horror that works really well. And it stands out because, you know, the way this film is scored, you almost expect some big melodramatic burst, you know, Cobalt 60, it can kill millions, dun-dun-dun, sort of thing. But Goldsmith takes a much more unsettling approach.
Is that the same unsettling theme that he plays over the main titles that's really subtle?
Thank you. One thing I really like about this cue is that it carries into the next scene. And as Vincent's girlfriend, June, rifles through his stuff and comes close to opening the Cobalt 60 cylinder, Jerry puts in these nifty little Guiro strokes, indicating that June may just be curious enough to open it.
The Guiro and some other weird percussion effects through this really, you know, remind me of later Goldsmith scores where he has an odd sound that he makes the distinctive element of that score. Everything from the pipes in Under Fire to even the electric guitar in Chain Reaction, you know, he likes to find some unusual instrument or something that he uses to flavor a score and make it unique. And that really does affect this one throughout it.
It's a nice little musical accent.
So at this point, for a while, the movie falls into a back and forth between Vincent spending time with his gal and the cops discussing their dire situation. We also get the first of two montages, this one depicting the big police rollout, alternating footage of cops getting in and out of cars, looking at maps, standing around, drawing on blackboards, operating radios, and taking phone calls. But at least we get a minute of energetic Goldsmith out of it to paper over the boringness.
I thought there was maybe even just some stock footage used in the movie. You don't really notice because Goldsmith puts this utterly badass distinctive music over it.
This is definitely one of the most exciting cues of the score. Percussion plays a big role in City of Fear, and the defining element, I think, is that little bongo rhythm. But here he breaks out the timpani, you know, to do something really big and dramatic for this sweeping, large-scale search they're doing.
I think that might be my favorite opening of any cue in the score. It's just so arresting.
The cops then question various people who knew Vincent.
June, of course, and Vince's former employer, Eddie Crown, and Vince's former associate, Pete Hallen.
Clark, how would you describe Pete Hallen as a character?
I would describe Pete Hallen as kind of a shifty lowlife. The thing that puzzles me a little bit about him, and if either of you picked up on something I didn't, let me know, but I think the movie is a little bit vague about what his relationship with Vince was exactly. We know that he's some sort of an associate of Vince's, which is why the police are interviewing him in the first place. But we don't really know how he was involved with him. But in any case, it was nothing good because Pete is, a sleazeball and makes that incredibly obvious right off the bat in his performance.
He's pretty lascivious.
He is. And he sits there in the police station, like, you know, pulling the gum, his chewing gum, like a foot out of his mouth, just so, you know, somebody will tell him not to do it and he can smirk at them. That's the kind of guy he is.
This tennis shoe-wearing beatnik.
Right.
He's defined by his shoes and the music theme that accompanies them. In the score, there are a couple cues. There's tennis shoes and there's the shoes. That's the most important part of him as a person, somehow.
It's so unusual that he gets this very distinctive musical identity apart from the rest of the film and plays such a kind of nothing role in the actual story.
I almost wonder if some of those 15 minutes that were cut out was stuff involving his character. It is strange that Goldsmith gives him, for me, the most distinctive character theme in the score, and stylistically, the jazzy stuff is so far different from the rest of the more jagged modern orchestral writing that it really makes you think he's going to be a major player somehow.
This is my favorite cue. It's so unique. It stands out from the rest of the score. You know, you've got this double bass jazz beat that's really cool. And then this marimba melody added on top. It's so cool and relaxed, but it's also just slightly devious. You'll just be walking down the street, you know, listening to your Pono or whatever media player you use, and this track will come on shuffle, and you will adjust your stride to synchronize with the bass. And it's the kind of theme that'll just immediately make you feel cooler just listening to
just
it.
Just like Pete, the coolest character of all time.
It makes you feel cooler, but also slightly shifty.
I will say, this sequence where the police are interrogating the different people of interest is one area where you really notice the screenplay for this movie is a little bit sloppy. And trying to be stylish in the conventional noir sense. But for example, there's a line in there where you almost sense the police officer trying to do this Raymond Chandler type thing where he tells the lady, "You have a lot of answers, miss. I'll tell you a few." But it's just such a bad line.
There's very few lines in this movie that stand out as particularly good. There was one that kind of amused me when the police are like, "Riker's not smart, we're just stupid." It seems to not be able to be as clever as it wants to be.
Likewise, the moral weight of whether or not you tell the public about this, you know, because they're technically risking the public's safety by doing this search without telling them anything. You expect that to be a kind of bigger part of the equation than it ultimately ends up being. There's a lot of dramatic material you could explore there, but the movie doesn't really do anything with it.
You don't see any of the police characters wrestling with that decision for long in any sort of interesting way.
The script has a fair number of issues, but again, as we've already mentioned a couple of times, Jerry Goldsmith steps up to the plate time and time again to try and bring some energy and life to this movie, and does a remarkable job.
Yeah. Immediately after Pete's introduction, we get to the movie's second montage, which consists of Vincent walking around in the shadows, crossing a street, sitting down at a bus stop for a while, finally getting on the bus.
Riveting.
The music is in full effect here.
Yeah, and he does this cool pitched percussion eerie sound a couple times in this montage. It's completely different from the first montage.
Yeah, and in this one he kind of goes back to some of that more Herman-esque sound, and he also goes back to some of that bongo percussion that plays such a prominent role in this score.
Thank you.
I thought this scene, too, was one of the more interesting pieces of actual filmmaking. It's nothing great, but, you know, there is real tension in the way this is shot, as well as scored.
It feels like it should be building up to something, but then I don't really know what it is building up to.
Right, it doesn't go anywhere, but it's stylish getting there. Those close-ups of Vince's, you know, sweaty palms and everything.
Is this the build-up to another murder? What is going on here?
This is, I believe, this is Vince going to meet his former employer.
Vince has to go from point A to point B. Fair enough.
I'm reminded of that bit in Mel Brooks's High Anxiety, where John Morris provides that very intense Herman-esque music as Mel Brooks hurries through the airport, and then he concludes and gets out of it and goes, "What a dramatic airport!"
Jerry adds all the drama. I can just imagine watching this movie without his score, and it would feel 3 hours long, even though it's only 80 minutes.
At this point, we continue alternating between scenes of the police pursuing the case and scenes of Vincent getting worse and worse from radiation poisoning.
Was I the only person who was a little bit amused that in the way he's constantly trying to unsuccessfully get that canister open, the thing that's killing him?
That was one of my absolute favorite things about this movie, is him like using a hammer or throwing it against the wall or whatever, trying to open this device that, if it cracks open, could kill millions of people. It's a pretty fun little idea the film raises tension by playing with.
This is around the time that the movie started to feel the most padded to me. The only standout scenes are the ones in which there is music. There is, for instance, a scene in which a cop holding a Geiger counter out of his car window detects some radioactivity in a taxi cab and turns around to flag that cab down. This is the most modern-sounding Goldsmith action to me in this score, and the most straightforward. It's got the kind of sense of progression that I'm used to from his later works, and it keeps one-upping itself and adding ever more complications. Again, it's a scene that in the movie doesn't really have much consequence.
But for a moment, you think it's going to have consequence. And that's thanks to Jerry.
Yeah, Goldsmith does his very best to make it feel fast-paced and exciting anyway.
So how did you guys feel about the main actor, Vince Edwards?
He's functional. I don't think he really captures perhaps the depths of murderous rage this guy seems to contain.
Vince Edwards did not strike me. Actually, nobody in this movie struck me as a particular screen presence.
Let me just disagree with you momentarily. I do think that Sherwood Price as Pete Hallin has some screen presence and is suitably creepy feeling. So I enjoyed him. It just felt like he didn't really have the room to develop the character because of the script or the fact that there's not much of him.
This isn't an actor's movie. To begin with, the script doesn't give the actors a whole lot to chew on, and none of the actors really rise above the material. They're all fine, like they deliver their lines credibly enough.
It is now time for us to give our final assessments and assign scores from 1 to 10, first to the film, and then to the score. The movie, City of Fear, covers the basics, but outside of the score, it is pretty artless, and some pivotal moments in the story happen off-screen and are confusing. I think if this movie had a different score or no score, I would have to rate it a 2 out of 10. However, this is truly a case of an excellent score adding tangible entertainment value to a movie, thus elevating it to a 4 out of 10.
That's exactly what I was leaning towards giving it. I was thinking if I was taking the score into account, it might notch up a little higher because it actually did make the film engaging for me. But I'm going to go with a final score of 4 out of 10 for the film as well.
I have to give the movie this. I think that it has a pretty entertaining B-movie premise. And I think despite its many shortcomings, the 75-minute running time kind of works in its favor because it gives you enough time to enjoy the film milking every last drop out of that premise before the well runs dry. And even though it's not a great film, it's flawed in many, many ways, I kind of had an okay time with it. I'm going to give this one a 5 out of 10.
That's only 1 point lower than you gave Black Patch, though.
I thought Black Patch was decent. Yeah, I think that you have to judge each movie in terms of what it's trying to accomplish. I think if you compare star ratings to star ratings across every single movie, you can find maddening things. But
sure.
But yes, I think you have to, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well does this movie do what it's trying to do?
Black Patch just had so much potential to be even greater than it was.
Right, so you basically, it led you to have higher expectations than were met, whereas this one doesn't give you high expectations and it just kind of meets them.
Exactly.
The score is emblematic of the kind of assignment where Jerry finds himself with a subpar canvas, but he's going to try for an interesting painting anyway. The in-your-face overscoring, it does date this more than most of Jerry's scores to me. But then again, it's really fun to listen to, and it has a ton of personality. And there's just a lot to like here if you enjoy Jerry in action and suspense mode. So I would give this a 7 out of 10.
I'd have to say that it has a lot of really enjoyable ideas and really lifts the movie in a prominent way, as we've already talked about. But I think I'd agree. It's a 7 out of 10 score for me, too.
I'm going to just rate it slightly lower at a 6.5 out of 10 because just for my own personal taste, it didn't grab me. And well, I don't know that, you know, a month from now, I'm going to be humming that jazz theme, even though that was the most memorable thing to me. I think also there are later examples of Jerry doing this kind of score significantly more memorably. Even though it stands out so much in the film, I have trouble, you know, recalling elements as much compared with later scores in a similar modernist vein.
So, Jens, that brings us to the famed Goldsmith ratio.
Uh-huh. This is to probe the conventional wisdom that Jerry's scores are usually by some magnitude better than the films that they accompany. And we're going to divide the rating for Jerry's music by the rating of the film, and thus determine how far above the material he's writing. Averaging our ratings, we now have the movie at a 4.3, and for the music, a 6.8. So, according to our formula, Jerry's music for A City of Fear is 1.6 times as good as the film that it accompanies.
Which is, we should note, a new record, breaking last week's Goldsmith ratio
of 1.3. As always, this is the part of the show where we must warn you that if you care about City of Fear spoilers, at this point you should pause the podcast, see the film, and then resume the remaining discussion. Unfortunately, City of Fear was only released once on DVD in the Columbia Pictures Film Noir Classics 2 collection, which is now hideously out of print and going for over $130 on the secondary markets. Somebody did upload it to YouTube, though, and you can find it there if you look hard enough.
Yeah, but before people who don't want to be spoiled shut this off, we want to recommend that they pick up the only official release of the score on Entrada Records. They did a really great job mastering the sound quality and providing great liner notes. The score, though it has been out of print for some time, you can find new copies on the secondhand market for around $30 and used copies for maybe $8 or $9 less than that. So it's one that if you're interested, you should definitely seek out.
We'll be back with spoilers after the beam. So there are weird gaps in this story. Pete Hallin, the character with the funky jazz theme, he is suddenly found dead, and we can only assume that Vincent did this off-screen.
Yeah, there's no death scene. And that's true, you know, most of the people who die in this movie, aside from his partner at the very beginning, Vince's victims just sort of die off-screen in some vague way.
And this is a character who was set up to be this really cool antagonist. It makes all those earlier scenes establishing him seem pretty pointless.
I had to do a double take. I was like, wait, that's the character who died? You know, that's such a waste of that one interesting character.
But at least his body gives the police an important clue in locating Vincent. His murder is also the reason why Eddie Crown, who is Vincent's former boss that he wants to sell the heroin to, turns against him.
That turns out to be a terrible idea, because Eddie, like so many others in this film, is killed by Vincent, who is tired of people complicating things for him.
This is sort of a refreshing change, because this is a murder we actually witness.
Yes.
The scene is done in kind of an interesting way. We sort of perceive it from the point of view of Eddie Crown's assistant. She kind of overhears it from the other room, and we see her reaction.
That moment is played just right, in my opinion. She manages to act like somebody who goes to the very edge of not being able to suppress a scream, but then she just manages to stay quiet.
It saves her own life.
One of those stray good moments littered throughout this film.
So Vincent stops to get some water at a gas station, but this is also where he drops the canister of Cobalt 60, and an old gas station attendant picks it up and takes it with him.
This was one part that I was disappointed in the movie, because it seemed to get resolved so easily. You think it's going to be this big problem, but he just drives back and finds the canister pretty quickly and then goes on his merry way again.
Yeah, it ultimately ends up just feeling like another piece of padding.
Another thing I found disappointing is that there's no City of Fear in City of Fear. The cops debated great length whether to make an announcement about the radioactive material and evacuate the city, but the announcement doesn't happen until a minute and a half from the end of the film, and we never see panicked townspeople. Just as the announcement goes out and the police have cornered Vincent in a bar, he dies of radioactive poisoning, though there's one last exciting piece of chase music just before then as the police chase Vincent to the bar.
One slightly poignant element of this final sequence is when Vince hears the announcement on the radio of the true identity of what he's carrying and that it's killing him. He's so desperate to keep believing it's his salvation, not his destruction. He clutches it all the way up to the final fate that awaits him.
And it's almost kind of funny the way the police just sort of unceremoniously toss a blanket over him and stick a, you know, warning radioactive sign on top of him, you know, just leaving his body there on the sidewalk.
So the Cobalt 60, okay? The stuff was being used for experiments on prisoners at St. Quentin?
Yeah, I didn't understand that. Like, how did it get mixed up for heroin? Why did he think he'd gotten heroin?
This part of the movie's premise strikes me as insane.
It had to be just the tiniest of doses being used in experiments, because they say, you know, just this canister being opened, millions of people will die. You have to imagine that even just a little tiny bit of this being used on the prisoners would cause everyone in the prison to die at the very least. It's baffling.
Throughout the movie, the local cops don't alert the feds in any way and don't bother to wear protective clothing when following the Cobalt 60 around with their Geiger counters.
They should have hired a better scientific advisor on this thing, but alas.
Thank you for joining us for our discussion of City of Fear. It is now time for a new section of the show, the mailbag. We've gotten some nice compliments and some constructive feedback. Thank you all for writing in. I assure you I read every piece of correspondence. Today, I want to focus on a few pivotal pieces of feedback that we received. First, we've got some comments from composer Jet Hit.
He says, if you are going to do a podcast about Goldsmith, then do it about Goldsmith. I listen to you guys ramble on about a movie that I will likely never see for 19 minutes before I ever heard a note of Jerry. Seriously, we don't need your critique of an obscure movie from 60 years ago. You're not Roger Ebert. Your show is supposed to be about Jerry Goldsmith, so make it about Jerry Goldsmith. Get on topic, please.
He later tempered that, saying he felt he had been a little too blunt, but we can appreciate some blunt feedback at times.
Yeah, you know, I like honest, constructive criticism. I do appreciate his point. The show is called The Goldsmith Odyssey, and we took a long time to get to Jerry Goldsmith. But let me say, in our defense, when we conceived this idea, the point wasn't just to explore the music of Jerry Goldsmith, as much as we love it, but to take a journey through his filmography and through all of these many films that he scored and explore the movies themselves as well as the music so that we can, you know, dig into that idea that Goldsmith's music was often a lot better than the movies that he scored. So we're trying to offer a combination of both film analysis and score analysis over the course of this journey. I understand that certain people will like certain parts of that equation better than the other, perhaps, but we're hoping to provide an informative and interesting balance, and we'll continue to make an effort to do that.
I should acknowledge that Jet is not the only one who has written us things along these lines. Just the bluntest. Jet, you can blame the initial format entirely on me, Jens. I have a deep love for many of these films, so I wanted the show to be just as much about the films and about the interesting connections around the films. We, and especially Yavar, were always concerned, though, that some people who are here purely for Jerry's contribution would react exactly the way that you did. We hear you. We are always listening to feedback and adjusting the show. I hope that today's episode is more in the direction of what you're looking for.
What Jens is not mentioning is that when I passed your feedback along to him, he took it so much to heart that evening that anyone listening to it now will be getting a special cut where we get to Jerry within about 8 minutes.
This is something that the three of us are constantly in conversation about and disagreeing about sometimes about exactly what the balance should be or where we should put everything, but we are taking all of these thoughts into consideration.
I also want to express my deepest gratitude to you for your piece, Yellowstone for Violin and Orchestra, and the pleasure that it has given me over the last 16 years.
For those of you who don't know it, it is like the greatest Western score never written. It's a concert piece, so it's got the natural flow and development of a concert piece, but it really evokes the best Western film music. Go check it out. It's a great piece by Jet Hit. So that's a good segue to the feedback we have from another composer, professional composer for video game music, going by the handle Wagner Almighty. Wagner writes, I had a great time checking out the Odyssey and its focus, Black Patch. I'm happily surprised to see how many risks Goldsmith took in writing a somewhat iconoclastic Western score, and elated to hear how his interest in making more subtle, psychologically oriented cues shows so plainly in his very first score. I mean, he was a master of that approach. When I listened to the first show, Zero, I found it very engaging, but of course I was impatient to have favorites like Freud scheduled. My impatience is over. I'm really glad you guys turned me on to Black Patch, as it's especially interesting given its quality this early in the maestro's career. And they added at the end that our balance of film discussion to music discussion was dead on. So we're interested to hear what other people think, and we are open to all feedback you'd like to send into our mailbag.
Okay, for all of you people writing in nice things, we greatly appreciate it. As I said, I read it all. I would encourage you, if you really like the podcast, to please go on iTunes and leave a review for us with those same sentiments.
Yes, if you have nice things to write in, put it on iTunes. If you have blunt things to tell us, send it to our mailbag. You can leave that off iTunes. That's just fine.
Right.
In fact, please send that email to mail@goldsmithodyssey.com.
And join us next time as we look into Jerry's third feature score, Face of a Fugitive.